You're listening to the Yeshiva of Newark podcast. I'm your host and curator, Rabbi Avram Kibalevich, and I hope you enjoy this episode. With downloads approaching the million mark, and an archival library numbering in the thousands, the Yeshiva of Newark podcast has been striving to continuously upgrade our content, professionalize our audio sound, along with altering approaches in light of much-appreciated listener feedback. I firmly believe that a niche has been carved out that resonates with many on the wide spectrum of observant Jews. This explains why we continually rank high in independent online lists of top yeshiva podcasts. That proud edifice is in real danger of toppling and disappearing. We need the help of our listeners to continue to record and edit, to promote a product that has been a balm and instructor to so many. Just $36. As a minimum donation from 1,000 of you out there will keep us afloat as a Newark of straight, intelligent, humorous discussion, lectures, debate, and inquiry, while the destructive waters of ignorance and identity politics, cyberbullying, crash around us. Your generous contributions will seal and galvanize this ark till it comes to a satisfying rest in an era of Moya Ritzdeya, heralding Mashiach, B'mheira, B'yameinu, Amen. And now, Emeritus Rex. 40 years in a row. This is Emeritus Rex with Rabbi Reuven Yeshua Pupko of Kote St. Luke's Premier Synagogue, Beth Israel, Beth Aaron. Rabbi Pupko, there was outrage this week. CNN says that the White House exploded with anger and frustration over a drone strike that occurred near the Mediterranean Ocean, where trucks that were clearly marked on their tops as being from the World Central Kitchen, two big convoy trucks that had recently unloaded material that had come in from Cyprus, and the trucks were hit by an Israeli drone. There was actually a third vehicle that I saw an image of, which resulted in not only the loss of food, but also the death of 7 aid workers who came from various countries, Australia, Poland, and three from the UK. This was owned up to by Israel. Israel admitted that this was a tragic and terrible mistake. It was not a target specifically, but there has been, of course, condemnation from all different, besides the White House, which is outraged. There's been condemnation from countries across the gamut. And I even saw today, Rabbi, that the CNN experts say that it's very unlikely that they did not see how this was clearly marked, because these drones are connected to a surveillance drone, and the surveillance drone has very accurate images. It really boggles the mind to think that this was a target, that they actually wanted to stop aid. They were actually trying to kill these people. And yet that is what is being implied even by the heads of the organization. And this has resulted in many other aid societies declining to continue any sort of work in Gaza. And it is once again, it's like some sort of red line has been crossed.
Listen, it was a tragic, tragic mistake. Now, listen, the reaction has been over the top a little bit, given the recent experience of the U.S. Army and the British Army in places like Afghanistan, where the Americans would bomb a wedding party and go, oops. You know, it's the reality of close combat is civilians will be killed. There will be terrible accidents. This is being used by Israel's detractors as a pretext for further condemnation. It's being used by some aid organizations that have revealed their true intent here. Their true intent, if their true intent was to help the suffering masses in Gaza, this would not be used as an excuse to halt deliveries. Their intent in being involved in Gaza is to condemn Israel. And that was certainly revealed in their response. You know, there have been times in this war where Israel was accused of things. Just this week, Israel was accused of harming UN peacekeepers in southern Lebanon. Everyone accused them. Israel said we wouldn't do it. And now finally the Lebanese are admitting it was a Hezbollah roadside mine that harmed the peacekeepers. And there'll be these accusations. And sometimes, tragically, there are terrible terrifying, horrible accidents in war with horrible consequences. And it happens in every war. Israelis have been killed in friendly fire in Gaza. Okay, Israel shot on its own people, shot hostages. And Israel has taken responsibility. But again, it does feed more ammunition to those who want to condemn everything Israel does.
When we think about the extent of taking responsibility, I assume what comes with it is also reparations and payments and monies and support to those families. I'm not sure if that's what has happened through the other actions that you've been talking about, things that happened in, whether it was in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places where collateral, quote unquote, damage occurred. The investigation, they said, is going to be thorough. Of course, Biden expects things to be really wrapped up. I mean, obviously, Biden's angry statements seem to be in conjunction with the loss of support he is getting in those crucial battleground states, specifically Michigan. We've talked about that before. On the same day that this happened, there was a sale of F-15 fighter jets that are going to Israel.
The weapon shipments from America are quite substantial. More weapon shipments, as you mentioned, were revealed this week in the media. They're sending over the huge 2,000-pound bombs. I mean, they're sending an enormous amount of ammunition to Israel. They can't be discounted here. But the politics, the rhetoric is getting worse. The media leaks yesterday talked about how that video conference, remember when after the UN vote, Bibi canceled the visit of Hanegbi and Dermer to Washington. But then that meeting took place on Monday virtually. It took place and apparently was a very angry meeting. The Americans said that the Israelis don't have a plan. And the rhetoric of that meeting was very, very strongly critical of Israel in that meeting, according to media leaks. And talking about Israel doesn't have a viable plan to remove civilians from Rafah before an impending attack. There's a report this morning in the Arab media that the Americans have promised the Egyptians that Israel won't attack Rafah till mid-May, which means there's further and further delays in the final target of in Gaza because of American pressure, because Israel needs to come up with two things, according to the Americans. Not just moving the civilians out of harm's way in Rafah, but coming up with a day after plan for Gaza. And I'm not sure it's a logical argument, but the Americans, for instance, last week when Israel had to go back to Al-Shifa Hospital for a two-week battle at the hospital, right, that this is an indication that Israel efforts in Gaza will come to naught unless they have a plan for governing Gaza the day after. America was very critical, used the Al-Shifa Hospital assault as evidence that Israel doesn't have a plan. In other words, they had cleared that area months ago, and yet it was retaken by a very large group of terrorists.
Of course, America doesn't necessarily offer what they think is the plan. They just condemn Israel for not having one.
Well, they keep talking about a revitalized Palestinian Authority. Obviously, the Palestinian Authority, in Israel's estimation, is not a viable option. You know, Abbas, with great fanfare this week, announced a new cabinet. Two of those members are people who have said terrible things about Israel and about Jews. But that's his revitalized thing. Abbas today said something interesting. He criticized Iranian meddling in Palestinian affairs, seeking to distance himself from Iran, unlike Gaza, which is a paid client of Iran. So the Americans are pushing the Palestinian Authority as the option. Bibi doesn't want to hear about it. Many Israelis don't want to hear about it.
Yeah. You mentioned Iran. The Israelis had struck a Syrian consulate.
Right. The Iranian building next door to the Iranian consulate in Damascus. Now, this is a very important moment. This may be a defining moment. Time will tell. Because, hey, listen, to use words like it's the first time, it might be an exaggeration. But it's clear that Israel has finally taken the battle not to Iranian proxies, but to Iran itself. Now, I don't mean the geography of Iran, but Iranian high-ranking officials
who happen to have an office or a building in Syria, and that was targeted.
Right. Iran plays a serious role in Syria. Iran is all over the place in Syria. So they bombed that building. And remember, Israel's been suffering from Iranian proxies from Lebanon in the name of Hezbollah, the Shiite militias in Iraq and in Syria, and the Houthis in Yemen. Remember, in response to the killing, the first thing that happened was a Shiite militia in Iraq sent a drone through Jordan that targeted a building in Eilat. I mean, things are, you know, some people are speculating this morning that Iran's going to hold off on any serious retaliation. But I know across the world, Israeli consulates and embassies have been told to, you know, to limit the movement of their personnel due to the threats coming from Iran.
We started today speaking about obviously a terrible mistake on the aid workers, but this probably was not any sort of errand drone. Why do you think they wanted to sort of begin this sort of destructive behavior? What do they expect to gain by it? They're just sending a message to Iran, don't stop pushing us around? Why now, in the middle of this, you know, very complicated and difficult war, should we make that strike? Maybe it would have been better after, you know, somehow some resolution of the Hamas situation to now go after Big Daddy.
I think it's the perfect time to do it. First of all, because Iranian proxies have been upping their attacks on Israel and on shipping in the seas off Yemen. But more importantly, it's a message to Iran that if Hezbollah continues and to expand, the Iranians are going to pay a price. Most people believe that the day will have to come when Israel and Iran have a direct confrontation, whether over the impact. Remember, every Israeli government has said they will not tolerate a nuclear armed Iran, and they keep enriching uranium, they keep enhancing their missile technology and their delivery systems. So it's inevitable. A conflict with Iran is inevitable. And rather than wait, it may be, Israel's patience is finally worn out.
Sounds a little bit like footsteps of a Gogol Mogol. Footsteps indeed were being on the ground in Yerushalayim last night, where protesters sort of got very violent near Netanyahu's Yerushalayim residence, demanding, I think, him step down. And there was water cannons and dogs. Seems like this unity government is definitely being challenged by many, many people. Do you think it's the same people that were fighting against judicial reform? This seems to have an even more emotional and violent nature.
I don't think the numbers yet match the judicial reform demonstrations, but certainly some of the same actors, some of the same leaders. The demonstrations till now were mostly about the hostages. Over the last month or so, they've evolved to demand resignations and elections. Listen, we're 6 months into this war. There are, you know, most political observers in Israel believe that Bibi's days as prime minister are numbered. And that reckoning has been delayed by the war. And the day after the war seems further away than ever. And therefore, there's a growing impatience. Listen, there are people who think Bibi should resign simply because of the failures that led to October the 7th. There are people who think he should resign, you know, long before that. So, or long before, you know, the events of October 7th. It's sad. It's tragic that the unity which characterized Israel immediate aftermath of October 7th, which I think still dominates, is being threatened by these demonstrations.
Right. Again, and we always sort of want to take demonstrations with a grain of salt. They always represent a minority of the populace, but they are able to garner a lot of public attention based on the fact the news is generated by the people with the loud mouths and who make a lot of noise. And again, I should throw in here also the images that I saw this week of a small children, Haredi children, sitting on the streets of Yerushalayim, being dragged by their feet by Israeli police as they were protesting the cessation of the draft exemption and the monies that will therefore now, the spigot of money that will be turned off to many of these institutions. Again, these images, which of course the news outlets love to show, all sort of highlight a country that seems to be perhaps in more turmoil than it really is. But those are the images that we see. Let's move to North America a little bit. This week there were, I think, you know, two important moments of things that happened in synagogues. Let's talk first about what happened on Friday in the Aguda Sholem Synagogue in a city you spent a little time in as a young man, Stamford, Connecticut. But it was actually, of course, the home city of Senator Joe Lieberman of blessed memory. I was able to watch half of the funeral. It was very interesting because the funeral led off, although with some Tehillim translated afterwards. It had four or five politicians began, or ex-politicians, senators and ex-governors in Connecticut, including Al Gore. And it was quite a tribute to Lieberman, clearly a type of persona that is very much absent in the regular public debate and the political debate, a very charming, ebullient, menschlich type of human being who worked very hard to create coalitions, even among people that he virulently disagreed with, but never turned to rancor and anger.
Listen, Joe Lieberman was widely, unfortunately, you know, there are people who can't see past certain things. Joe Lieberman, like many Democrats at the time, supported the attack on Iraq after 9/11. And, you know, for some people in America, that is the defining issue. And there are people who criticize him till today because he's supporting, forgetting, and they involved in selective memory about how many Democrats have voted for that. I mean, you know, it's for the attack on Iraq. And people forget the context. People forget. I mean, you remember the debates before the Iraq invasion of the UN Security Council, you know, where Colin Powell presented the evidence later turned out to be incorrect about weapons of mass destruction. And you remember how the French were against the assault. Those people who were against the attack on Iraq never said the intelligence was wrong. Never. They just said, give the sanctions more time and let the UN inspectors do their job. They never, ever questioned the intelligence. Everybody believed Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. And yet you still have people on the left going around screaming Bush lied. There is not a shred of evidence that anyone engaged in deliberate deception about the weapons of mass destruction. Yes, the intelligence is wrong. It's because Saddam Hussein wanted everyone to believe he had weapons of mass destruction. Right. His own generals thought it. I know, I'm fighting the last war. And we're supposed to talk about Joe Lieberman. But Joe Lieberman was an extraordinary mensch. And I was just upset that people continue to criticize him in ways that are really incorrect.
Oh, I'll tell you what Lieberman said in a number of interviews post that, that he, based on his understanding of the Torah, that the Jewish people and the rest of the world as well need to be governed by law and by discipline. And 9/11 to him was an example of an attack on the greatest democracy in the world. And therefore, the war was necessary as a way to impose law, to get back at the people who are trying to destroy the fabric of civilization. He saw it in line with his ideals. He was not a warmonger. He was not a person who wanted deaths, but he was a person that was morally driven, and it was very much inspired, again, he by the Torah, and not just the Torah as, well, you know, the very Hillary Clinton Tikkun Olam type of idea. He felt that it was, you know, Midas Adin is necessary in order to create a civilized society and a civilized world. So I think that was part of why, you know, he felt decisive action needed to be taken to just allow terrorism and Islamic terrorism to just run rampant was not something that he could tolerate.
I mean, it's remarkable how close he came to being vice president. I mean, a couple of hundred
hanging chads in Florida, and
it's painful to think about what could have been, and not to live with regrets about that. and what, you know, what America would look like and how things might be different today had that election, you know,
you think so? I mean, I discussed this on a previous podcast, and our listeners can find it, a tribute to Joe Lieberman that I conducted with one of his friends, Willie Ratfogel. I mentioned to him that W turned out to be an incredibly positive president for Medina Yisrael. Of course, he was the one that, agreed to send the massive troops into Iraq and to topple Saddam Hussein's regime.
I don't think Al Gore would have gone into Iraq. I think he would have fought in Afghanistan after 9/11. I'm not sure he would have gone to Iraq.
Well, since we are talking about Al Gore, and from a senator from my home state, from Tennessee, he was the last sort of non-Jewish speaker. He compared his relationship with Lieberman to Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, who had been good friends, who had worked together on the Declaration of Independence, but then became bitter political rivals. But as they approached the day of their deaths, and you know they both died on the same day, July 4th, 1826. And I think John Adams on his deathbed said, you know, Thomas Jefferson still lives, and that is somehow the epitaph to his life. He brought out, I think, in a meaningful way, how friendships can overcome bitter political arguments and divisiveness, how important it was to bond over commonality of the human spirit. I thought he did a great job. It was a very beautiful, moving tribute. I'm going to go into an area here which you might be a little bit uncomfortable with, and that was, despite the fact that it was in a synagogue and Lieberman being was a very ardent supporter of Israel throughout his Senate and throughout his whole political life, a believer in Eretz Yisrael, went there and supported so many religious causes, there was very little protest there. I mean, this was not a place, even though it was a gathering in a synagogue, another gathering in a synagogue that occurs a couple of days before that, in Teaneck, there was a political protest by pro-Palestinian groups were planned at the B'nai Yeshurun Synagogue in Teaneck. So the B'nai Yeshurun Synagogue, the largest synagogue in Teaneck, was holding a fundraiser for Zaka. Now, Zaka, of course, for all our listeners know, are the people who are these ultra Chevra Kaddishinikers.
Listen, those people did a remarkable job on October 7th. Many of their members are deeply, I hate to use the word because I don't have a better one, traumatized by what they were exposed to in the days after the attack on October 7th. They do a great job. And for the protesters to show up to protest the humanitarian organization that is involved in the sacred work is insane. It was nice to see that the Jews of Teaneck and elsewhere responded to the call to protect the synagogue and to counter protests, and the Jews showed up en masse, and the Palestinians, the pro-Hamas demonstrators, you know, were outnumbered and ended up walking away chagrined. So that was a good thing.
The justification was supposedly that Zaka is propagating lies. Now, again, obviously, we talked about the lack of information, what people know, what people didn't know, but to protest Zaka, which is not an official arm of the Israeli government. These are all volunteers. Simcha Greinemann has been a very vocal spokesman. He testified at the UN about the evidence of sexual abuse that he saw committed on October 7th. He's obviously someone that has been a person that could speak to the media, and I think he was the main speaker there. You mentioned to me before we started recording that they protest in Sloan Kettering too. So where they will protest is always defying logic. But I think that the Jewish response to have a peaceful counter demonstration, I think, is in very much contrast to the demonstrations that we have in Eretz Yisrael. It seems like the Americans get it. I don't hear that much in terms of, of any violence or any pushing. It's almost like a kumsitz. You know, you have the Israeli music and other things, people wrapping themselves in Israeli flags. Look, it's been a hard 6 months, and I guess Teaneck and other modern Orthodox Jewish communities need that sort of release. But it really shows us what we're dealing with when protests can erupt even against Zaka. Rabbi Pupko, I know that now you're going to engage in the most intense and exciting really part of the year as you will, as your community and the rest of Klal Yisrael gets ready for Pesach, which needs so much preparation. So we will probably catch you on the other side of Yontif. We wish you, of course, a Chag Kosher V'Sameach, and hopefully we're going to hear the sounds of Geula Hamitis. Take care, everybody. Be well.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I hope you liked what you heard. If you did, please take a moment to share this or any of the many episodes available on our platform with friends in order to help grow our community. Until next time, Shalom.